This is PCJ Radio International.
Radio Berlin International.
Ici Radio Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Well, hello, friends and listeners, and welcome to the monthly edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. The monthly edition, of course, is a monthly supplement to the weekly version, the weekly 30-minute version that we do of the program. We actually have many things to get to today, so I think we should kick off right away with WRN. What is WRN? WRN is the World Radio Network based in London. Now, they're a unique broadcaster because they rebroadcast other broadcasters. It's one of the few satellite networks in the world where one moment you can hear Radio France International, Deutsche Welle, even Voice of Korea. Well, recently I caught up with one of its founders, Jeff Cohen, while he was visiting Taiwan, and we sat down to talk about a little bit about its history and its humble beginnings.
Well, we're 21 years old now. We started at the beginning of 1992, and we had the idea that the sort of platforms available to broadcasters would be changing. And why didn't we create networks that had programs in a single language from a variety of broadcasters? At that time, the broadcasters had the idea, let's move on to new platforms like satellite, but we'll put all of our different languages one after the other. And we said, well, look, it's, you know, you're not going to get an audience who's just there for your half hour in English or your half hour in French. Why don't we start channels that mm-hmm. are all in a single language, and then you can, you know, you'll be able to, you know, get an audience. So we did that. It actually wasn't the thing that we first did, because we were all the three of us who started what was the World Radio Network were working at the BBC, and we had these ideas, but it didn't look like it was going to be feasible. We didn't have any money or any other resources to do it. But we were very lucky. We managed to get a contract with Vatican Radio. At the beginning of 92, they desperately needed some satellite distribution in Europe, and we arranged a channel for them. And on the basis of the income, we were able to get offices, and we were able to launch the English channel in September to Europe, and then by the beginning of 93, we were broadcasting to North America.
What was the reaction from other international broadcasters? Because I can just picture them at a meeting. You're sitting there and you're saying, look, we want to bring together you, put them all together in one channel. Was there any, did anybody say, well, look, I don't want to be on a channel with another broadcaster who is, say, our competitor? Was this issue ever brought up?
Yeah, it was. It was generally the feeling that it might erode their brand. They all believed, well, not some believed that they had a very, very strong brand, and that people would come to them for that brand. But others were more pragmatic. They realised that they actually needed to find a way to get audiences. Those that had the smallest amount of programming were the easiest to persuade. The likes of Radio Sweden, Vatican Radio, they knew that they wouldn't, you know, be able to. The people wouldn't be motivated to come to their programming wouldn't be motivated to come to their frequency for half an hour in English or French or German. So they were very, very keen on the idea, and they really have sustained us.
But what about, like, for example, the big broadcasters in Europe? Let's say like BBC World Service or Deutsche Welle, which is still large by European standards. Were they less warm on the idea?
Yes, in general. We had a very difficult relationship at times with our former colleagues at BBC, who saw us as a sort of a rival. But the other large broadcasters like RFI, Deutsche Welle, and to some extent Voice of Russia have felt that they really needed to build up their own brand with their own frequencies that would carry as much programming as possible. Mm-hmm. So they haven't been the ones that have been most important to us on the radio networks. But in some of the services we have had broadcasting from particular broadcasters because we can offer platforms that otherwise would be difficult for them to get onto.
Well, let's talk about the platforms because a lot of people may think that WRN is just satellite. It's not just satellite. You also have the live web streams. You have different streams, let's say, for Asia Pacific, Africa, North America, Europe. But there are, of course, a lot of other stations around the world that will relay WRN on medium wave and FM networks. So would you say you're sort of like a new, not just a platform to listen to these broadcasters, but also a distributor for other broadcasters, let's say, that would not have their programming, let's say, air in New Zealand, but are now having their programming air in New Zealand and maybe the US and some other areas that normally they wouldn't?
Yeah, that's right. We pick up a lot of broadcast relays sort of free, mm-hmm. because there are stations looking for content. The problem we have is we very often can't guarantee how long it's going to last. Very often, if a broadcaster wants a serious relay agreement and it's paying a station to relay its broadcasts, it's got some sort of guarantee that it's always going to be there. Those ones that you kind of refer to, the more casual relays, that come along because the content is required. Yes, they're great, and some of them, can be around 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years. We've had some, but they're in different places, not necessarily places that are necessarily strategic interest to the our partner stations, they're very useful, and some of the platforms we've been on, cable platforms and whatever, have picked up good audiences.
Now, since the day that WRN started, we've seen a lot of changes in international broadcasting, especially on shortwave. Some stations have cut back shortwave dramatically. Some have gone off shortwave dramatically. Some stations have just gone into broadcast history. What kind of impact has it had on you, for example, with stations like Radio Canada International gone? Radio Netherlands is still around, but they're not producing audio content anymore. They're producing some video, and they're producing content for overseas distribution by sending scripts. This must have left a lot of gaps in the schedule.
It has. It has very much. Particularly that programming that was of good quality, such as Radio Canada International, Radio Australia has gone, Radio Netherlands, they were very good, and it's a great pity. And there hasn't been anything really that we can get to easily replace it. Mm-hmm. So it's been a matter of having more repeats. So we actually are in the process now of reviewing the networks and reviewing the operation of the networks and seeing what we can do, because overall, as far as our company is concerned, these networks are a very small part. They were our foundation. Mm-hmm. They're the heritage of the company and what allowed us to move forward. But in radio, we're doing a lot more now, a great deal more. We're arranging relays, bespoke relays for many broadcasters like Voice of Russia and Radio Japan. About 60% of the company's revenue comes from television now. We're doing some fairly mainstream television work.
So what kind of television work is it? Is the television side sort of set up like the radio side by relaying or what?
4 years ago, we bought a TV company in London, it's called TSI Broadcast, and TSI was involved in ingest and playout, And so we are doing a lot of ingest and play out for channels that we send to different parts of the world. We package channels in London for the African market. We have an agreement with a company in New Caledonia in the Pacific, and we put together a bouquet of channels for them. In the world of television, you are in a very good position being based in London, because the movie studios much prefer dealing with centres like that, like London. There is a reluctance by a lot of the Hollywood companies to send content, particularly to Africa and Asia, because of the risk of piracy. So there are certifications that a company can get, which allows it to handle material much more easily. And we have all these necessary certifications at our offices, and so we can freely handle material, which there are restrictions on it going to other parts of the world, which puts London in a good position to do this kind of work of packaging channels together.
Getting back to radio for a moment and satellite radio, the U.S. and Canada have a service called Sirius XM. A few years ago, there was a service called WorldSpace, which is now gone. Do you see that there still is a future for this kind of global international satellite service, where you have a small receiver, a small dish, and you can pick it up from a satellite? Because it seems that WorldSpace just sort of vanished.
Yeah, WorldSpace, in theory, is still going, and we are providing an uplink station for WorldSpace. It carries data and video, and the WorldSpace took on a great challenge in serving Africa and Asia. Sirius was a much more easy prospect. I would say Sirius was a much more straightforward commercial prospect of contacting car manufacturers and planning a service based on a few very large retailers in the States selling it. WorldSpace had enormous problems because there are no established distribution networks for receivers in the areas they cover. Receivers seem to just get in by all kinds of importers here and there who don't even often very check whether the radios they buy are suitable for the local conditions. They'll buy some radios from the Far East that may be totally unsuitable for the wave bands, may be totally unsuitable for the audience. WorldSpace discovered this very late on, that it was in fact very difficult to get their radios in to the areas where they wanted to broadcast. They had very good intentions when they planned services, but it didn't really work out for them. The same technology that WorldSpace developed was sold to XM in the States, one of the two companies that merged to form Sirius XM, and it still works for them, and it's just a matter of getting the commercial model right. Sirius, I think the prospect is that Sirius will survive. The big change will be the use of IP for radio. I've just come back from the Radio Asia conference in Hanoi. Some people there were saying, we should have a radio set that does this. We should have a mobile phone that has a DAB chip in it. I think any discussion of hardware, radio hardware, is very, very, very difficult. It's a completely different matter to say, okay, you can get me on your iPad. You don't have to change the iPad in any way to do that. Changing hardware is very, very, and launching new hardware is very, very, very difficult.
Well, we've seen that with DRM. As much as I love DRM as a technology, from the receiver side, there really hasn't been much on the market, which is probably one of the reasons why a lot of broadcasters don't want to start using it, except for cases like Radio New Zealand International that are using DRM to distribute their content to other FM and medium wave stations in the Pacific, which I think is a great use for it, because it's a lot more economical than using satellite. But in some areas of the world to say, well, you know, DRM is by a DRM receiver. I don't think many people would spend $300-$400 for a DRM receiver. There recently was one that came on the market for about $140, but sound quality-wise was nowhere near a radio that you can buy for a lot less.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a similar experience with digital radio. In countries where digital radio is simply marketed as better quality than your FM radio, it's failed completely because generally the public is quite happy with FM, and in many cases the public is happy with AM. And
well, here in Taiwan, I remember a few years ago there were about 13 DAB stations on the air. As of today, 2013, there are two left, and they're only staying on till the end of next year because nobody wanted to go spend the say, $200, $250 to buy a DAB radio when they said my FM radio works fine.
Yeah, the UK has been the big exception as far as DAB is concerned because it's been highly successful in the UK. Yeah, a very, very large proportion of radio sets are DAB sets, which has been due to the big push that the BBC made in marketing it. And if you've got the power of the BBC behind you to market it, and a lot of very good thinking went into creating radio networks exclusively for DAB. Well, they weren't exclusive. In fact, they were available on other platforms. When they first launched, they were on DAB only. And the BBC managed to create a demand for those particular sorts of content. Radio 7 and 6 Music, mm-hmm. were very good ways of getting DAB established. But as far as the future of radio, it may be that we will move over to an IP based when cars have IP available in the car, a standard.
Well, it's funny you should say that. Because here in Taiwan, there's one company that has come out with a radio. In the radio, you put a G3 chip, and you can listen to internet radio in your car. A friend of mine has one of the test models, and it is kind of fun, because if you want to listen to BBC or VOA, you just work like any internet radio. And here in Taiwan, a lot of the local FM and AM stations are trying to legislate the NCC to pass laws against it. But the NCC is saying, yeah, but we have to look forward. We have to look towards new technologies. It's only because a lot of the local stations don't have adequate audio streams yet.
I don't see how you can make a law saying you've got an IP, you know, in your car if you can have it in your home. So
on
your phone. Yeah. So I don't see that. At this conference in Hanoi, the theme of the conference was radio and social networking. And this is one of the big concerns by radio broadcasters is particularly the young are moving to social networking. They're not spending the time listening to radio. They're not buying radio sets. The number of radio sets bought by the young now, mm-hmm. compared with 10, 20, 30 years ago, is tiny.
But this is something that we've seen happen before. I remember a number of years ago when people started downloading music off different websites like Napster and all that, a lot of the big music labels were so late to respond to this market and this demand that when iTunes came along with Apple, that was very successful. And it seems that with audio content or even video content, many broadcasters are just slow to respond.
Yes, but you look at where the word radio is used on the internet. Pandora Radio, you've got Last FM. These are internet websites which use the word radio because the word radio seems to have some, you know, particular relevance to the audience. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, radio as such is a word, you know, and a concept which means something to people. I think it's a matter of getting people to find you and establish yourself as a brand. There was a report by the European Broadcasting Union on the future of radio and the young. It was a couple of weeks ago it was published, and that report says that the radio stations should build up their brand. Once you've got a really good, strong brand, then you can make sure it's on all the different platforms, including the ones that the young use, and that's the way that you will you will find that they will find you seamlessly, depending no matter which platform you're on. The BBC did a presentation at this conference showing how they can make sure you will move seamlessly from your iPad to your radio set, and it was a very slick presentation, and it looked extremely impressive. I'm not sure to what extent it needs a clever listener to make it work. The EBU has got its faith in radio DNS, where a station is found by its name, no matter how it's transmitted, and you just put in the name, and whatever way in which that could be received, whether it's on FM or digital or the internet, the radio will find it by name. That's another way. But my general thinking is that if you want the young to listen to radio, you've got to employ young people. You've got to know what young people want in terms of programming.
This is something that we've seen in. We were talking about this earlier. How a lot of the big, not all, but some of the big public international broadcasters are sort of in this world that they got. They're sort of stuck. They've been doing things for maybe 30, 40 years in a certain way. They're not tapping into new markets. They're not changing the way they're doing things. And they're sort of being left behind. And then new startups that come along, like PCJ, we started in 2009, we're sort of going into areas that they're not going into. And then they look at us and they say, well, how are you doing it? And I'm like, well, you've got to change. You've got to do things that are innovative. But it seems that today in a lot of international broadcasters, I'm not going to mention any names, but certain ones that are based in Europe, and I'm not talking about the BBC, talking about certain other ones, they're stuck. They're continuing to do things as they did before, but they're not changing.
International broadcasting has always been like that. In fact, it's one of the characteristics of international broadcasting that it is intentionally conservative. It's like the BBC and Lily Bolero and Radio Newsreel. They stuck to these long after everyone else in the UK completely moved on, and UK radio was completely different. And you hear the same thing sometimes in some of the like the VOA language services, which sound very old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. There's something that is very hard to change, and you do feel that your listeners are used to that, marching tune at the start of your broadcast, and that if you change it, you'll lose those listeners. I think it's just an inherent problem. In one of the things about international broadcasting is that you speak slowly and clearly, and you have these auditory reminders of the way things were, but. It is possible to change. It is possible to change.
I know that at Radio Australia and also the ABC, there was a lot of discussion about playing that jingle that they've been playing on the hour, which they also do still on domestic radio and also on television, which they've been playing for probably over the last 70 years or something. And somebody at Radio Australia told me, he said they actually discussed about removing it. But he said, we haven't found anything that can identify ourselves with that tune. He said, now it's to the point where even though we wanted to change it, he said, we're stuck with it now. We're just stuck with it. But some other stations have things that they're playing at the top of the hour that they should have dumped years ago.
It's exactly it. It's like Lily Bolero in the BBC. It's still played a couple of times a day, just for old time's sake. Yeah. And the fact that if anyone comes to them and says, you got rid of Lily Bolero, they say, no, we haven't got rid of it. It's still played now. Once or twice a day, so you can do that. You can just leave it there, so that it hasn't been gotten rid of, but it's not it's not used so much that it's the normal hourly jingle. But people have been saying for I think since the end of the Cold War, international radio is about to go, and it hasn't yet. And we'll see. I think as long as so many of the big broadcasters are there and they hang in, then it's okay. When the BBC stopped their broadcast in North America, the other big broadcasters said, "You're crazy." you've got a very good shortwave audience, and moving to other forms of distribution in the States won't work. But it did work, and the others have generally followed suit, and there's hardly any shortwave broadcasting to North America now mm-hmm. as a result of that.
Yeah, I mean, the BBC now has a much bigger in the audience now in the U.S. than they did when they were on shortwave. But it didn't happen overnight. It took some time, but they were able to see that this was the way to go. But, you know, yet other broadcasters that are remaining on shortwave, I wonder how big an audience they still have. When I was working at Radio Havana, Cuba, and I remember how many letters we would get from the U.S., and I still know some people there, and they said, oh, yeah, we get maybe a few here and there, but they're always from the same people that want this certain QSL card.
sure, yeah. I mean, there are still some broadcasters that are, the old style, appealing to shortwave listeners, high school kids, QSL card collectors. But that's not really what the governments of these countries are paying their broadcasters. Then that's not who the governments of the countries are paying the broadcasters to reach. They want to reach a general audience, mm-hmm. And often the audience who are otherwise listening to serious news and current affairs programs. That's the target audience, and that's what the BBC aimed for in North America. Look, the target audience, the people who are readers of Time and Newsweek, mm-hmm. and that's really, if you think about who your government is paying you to reach, they're the people.
I was speaking there with Jeff Cohen, one of the founders of the World Radio Network. And you can catch the 30-minute edition of Media Network Plus on WRN at various times, as the show airs three times on the weekends to Africa, North America, Asia, and the Pacific. Just go to WRN.org. That's WRN.org. You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The British DX Club is one of the world's leading DX clubs, with hundreds of members both in the UK and around the globe. BDXE produce a comprehensive monthly magazine called Communication, covering all aspects of the DXing hobby. The BDXE Audio Circle is also available and is a monthly program of DX catches and general chat about radio. For more information, please write to the British DX Club, 10 Hemdeen Hill, Caversham, Reading, RG4, 7SB in the United Kingdom, or visit the website at www.bdxc.org.uk. That's www.bdxc.org.uk.
We now turn our attention to Zimbabwe, where Robert Mugabe was elected again as president. Now, Zimbabwe is one of those countries where there is only one official broadcaster, and that's the ZBC, or the Zimbabwe Broadcasting Corporation. Now, if you're planning to start a private television station or radio station in Zimbabwe, forget it. ZANU-PF has controls over the airwaves and who gets licenses. But this changed recently. First TV, based in South Africa, broadcast to Zimbabwe daily on satellite. Its content, about Zimbabwe. One of the people behind the station is David Smith. He now joins us on the program to talk more about this fascinating project.
South African President Jacob Zuma has silenced Lindiwe Zulu, his foreign relations advisor and point person to Zimbabwe. A Newswire reported...
No, we did not get a license, a broadcast license for Zimbabwe, because quite simply, we would not be given one. There is no broadcaster, no TV broadcaster in Zimbabwe other than the state broadcaster, the ZBC. And the ZBC is probably the best example I can think of a state broadcaster being his master's voice, because the ZBC is truly the voice of the ruling party, ZANU-PF, or more correctly, the president of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe. Now, we're broadcasting on satellite from South Africa to literally millions of homes in Zimbabwe who are using free-to-air satellite receivers. And you may ask, Zimbabwe, not one of the wealthiest countries in the world, how come so many people have satellite receivers there? And the answer is very simple. People hate the ZBC to such a large extent that they take, in many cases, what little money they have and go out and buy these free-to-air satellite receivers just so they can watch anything that isn't the ZBC. And up until July 1st of this year, most people bought these free-to-air receivers, which just happened to be made in China and are commonly known as WizTech, the brand name of most of the free-to-air receivers. Up until July 1st, most people bought them so they could watch the public broadcaster of South Africa, the SABC.
Mm-hmm.
Because until July 1st, the three main channels of the SABC, SABC 1, 2, and 3, were freely available on these WizTech receivers. On July 1st, that signal was scrambled, not for political reasons, but for commercial reasons. Another free-to-air broadcaster based in South Africa called ETV took the SABC and its signal distributor, Sentech, to court because it claimed that SABC was stealing business from its subscription service. And so the SABC was ordered, when ETV won the case, to scramble their signal. And that left a space for a new player. And because most Zimbabweans already had access to free-to-air satellite TV, we took advantage of this gap and created in Johannesburg a TV service that, although it's based in South Africa, is all Zimbabwe content for the most part, with Zimbabwe news, Zimbabwe current affairs, Zimbabwean presenters, footage, film, music coming from Zimbabwe, sent to us mainly through broadband connections, FTP sites. And we've been on the air since July 19th. And that date is not arbitrary. It was set up to cover the presidential elections that were held in Zimbabwe on July 31st, to give a chance to parties that weren't necessarily the ruling party to state their case. Because on the state broadcaster, only the ruling party is given airtime to campaign.
Well, let me ask you a question, David. When you were setting the station up, was there any concern at all? Because we've seen this happen in other parts of the world, where you have a satellite broadcaster targeting a specific country. That country then acquires satellite jamming equipment and then jams the signal. Was this something that was in the back of your mind when you were setting this venture up?
Hey, there's always a risk. I mean, the day we went on air in the government-controlled main newspaper in the capital city, Harare, the Herald, there was a piece about our station called First TV, in which the ruling party and Mugabe himself said he would cripple First TV. When somebody like Mugabe says he's going to cripple you, you've got to take that a bit seriously, because he's known for not the most peaceful tendencies in dealing with the opposition. And I should also point out that it's not an opposition television station. It's a television station to serve Zimbabweans, whether they support ZANU-PF and Mugabe or anybody else. And the purpose of this outfit is to give Zimbabweans of all political stripes and opinions a place to get together and talk about how to get out of the crisis and build a country. So, yes, to come back to your original question, Keith, you know, I mean, of course there's concern. We know that Mr. Mugabe has close links with the Chinese government, and the Chinese have put a fair amount of money into Zimbabwe, notably in things related to the ruling party. So there is a concern, but you know, if we just sit back and say these things might happen, well, no change is ever going to come to that country. You know, there have been a lot of courageous broadcasters all over the world since radio and later on TV started, who've used the power of electronic media to counter propaganda from very undemocratic regimes, and that's what we're trying to do. Yeah, now, is there a danger? Is there a risk? Of course there is, but so far so good.
Recently, I think it was last year, there were some reports in various news websites and also publications saying that the Zimbabwean government had authorities going around collecting up shortwave radios. Have satellite receivers ever been targeted? I mean, have authorities gone to people's homes saying, oh, you have a satellite dish, we're taking it away?
That's probably the risk we felt was more likely to turn into reality than the jamming of the signal. Because, you know, it's harder to hide a satellite dish than it is to hide a shortwave radio. know, if you walk by any house, any apartment block in any Zimbabwean town or even in rural areas, because all of the people with free-to-air satellite dishes are trying to receive the same satellite bouquet, all their dishes are placed in the same direction, so you know where to look for them. It hasn't happened yet, and I think it probably hasn't happened yet because it would make so many people so angry. Satellite dishes, the dish, the receiver, the installation costs roughly the equivalent of just under $100. You know, and for a rural Zimbabwean, or even somebody who lives in a township in a big Zimbabwean city, who may have an income as a street hawker or something not very lucrative like that, that's a lot of money. And to remove that equipment is not going to be very popular. And I should add that, you know, we did a feasibility study before setting up this station to see just how widespread free-to-air satellite receivers are in Zimbabwe. And one area where you find an incredibly large proliferation of these dishes is at police compounds throughout the country. If you were to take them away from the police, well, if you're a ruling party and you rule by force, you want to make sure that the police and other security forces remain on side. I can even point out that at ZANU-PF headquarters in Harare, the ruling party headquarters, there were a lot of these WizTech dishes mounted on the various floors of the large office building that is ZANU-PF headquarters. So, no, it hasn't happened yet. It could, but I think it might be a step too far for the ruling party to walk down that road.
So let me ask you, I mean, if I was able to receive this channel here and turn it on, you said that it mainly targets Zimbabwe. It is targeting a Zimbabwean audience, but would it be... I mean, do you also carry, say, content from other broadcasters on the channel as well?
Yes, no, we do. Because, you know, if we were to have programming that only talked about, you know, the build-up to elections, election day, election results, and alleged rigging of those elections, well, it would be hard, very difficult to keep an audience interested in that sort of thing, hour after hour, day after day, week after week. So what we've tried to do is, in some cases, pick up some of the programming that people used to watch on the SABC before the SABC signal was scrambled. We've purchased the rights for a very popular SABC soap opera called Zone 14, which we run on a daily basis on First TV. We've picked up some of the rights to some of the best locally produced feature films from Southern Africa. We've got a large selection of documentaries, especially documentaries dealing with Zimbabwe and Southern Africa that never would have been shown on the ZBC, because the ZBC doesn't show anything that might be even remotely critical of the ruling party. It's a new station. Hey, it's less than a month old. So we're building up our archive of material. The anchor of the programming, I should say, is our current affairs programs. We have an hour-long current affairs program where we get some of the main political and academic leaders of Zimbabwe or Southern Africa to talk about the issues of the day. We have open-line programs where Zimbabweans are invited to call and just get things off their chest. And they don't really have another way to do that, another output for their frustrations. These are the sort of things that a lot of people do on radio, mm-hmm. but that sort of option of, you know, getting things off your chest on radio does not exist in Zimbabwe.
Right.
So to some extent, First TV also performs the services that a radio would perform as well. And one other thing on that item, the radio on TV, because, as I mentioned at the beginning of this interview, the ZBC, the state broadcaster, is so unpopular, a lot of people use their free-to-air receivers not just to watch TV, but to listen to radio. Well, I told you a moment ago that the SABC TV channel signals were scrambled. The SABC radio service channels were not scrambled. And so many people listen to South African radio on their televisions. So when we mix television concepts with radio concepts on First TV, we're not really making, we're not really alienating any listener or viewer. They're already accustomed to that sort of thing.
Now, a moment ago, David, you said that, you know, Mugabe came out and spoke against First TV. There must be part of you thinking, well, that, you know, it's a good thing he did that, because if he's saying something bad about us and it's in the press, people are going to go under, well, why? What's wrong with this station, and end up watching you, right?
Well, sure. I mean, yes, the interesting thing is we don't really need to market it. We don't have to spend 1 cent on advertising to publicize the station, because in Zimbabwe, word spreads like wildfire about this sort of thing. Zimbabweans are extremely active on social media. So First TV, even before we went on air, set up a Facebook page, set up a Twitter account, set up a WhatsApp account, so that word would spread like wildfire on how to pick it up. And it's not as if we're dealing with much competition. There's only one other TV station in the country, and that's the ZBC, which many Zimbabweans refer to as the dead BC. So much as it's interesting to hear how Mr. Mugabe's criticism of the station might make us more attractive, we don't really need him to say anything at all. There is no competition out there. The bar was set very low by their state broadcaster.
David, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Nice talking to you, Keith.
And I was speaking there with David Smith, one of the people that's behind First TV, the first commercial TV station available in Zimbabwe. They are based, however, in South Africa. To find out more information, just go to Google and enter First TV, and you can watch their programs online. Well, Australia has an election just around the corner. In fact, next weekend. And the radio ratings chart for Australia recently came out, and they discovered that during an election, the radio audience goes up. Well, our good friend Richard Aidey now brings us this special report on that situation.
Hamish and Andy with you. It is the happy hour, one topic per day, and the topic today is Donald Trump.
Join the conversation now. Call 922-11882.
Excuse me. Oh, what's now, that though, coming out of the walls?
We are asking the question, how'd you lose your teeth?
My dad keeps telling us that the dentist told him he's got great teeth for a bloke his age. Only four of them are his.
And yeah, I wish I could say something cool in Triple J at this point, but I'm just not cool in Triple J. I hope I got away with it.
Yeah, no, you did. That's all you needed
to say. I
didn't
embarrass myself, did I?
Yes, the radio ratings are out this week, and we'll get to them in a tick. But it got me thinking, how does the election affect radio listening? Steve Ahern's a long-time radio professional. He's editor of radioinfo.com.au.
It is different from normal. Talk radio stations always benefit in election time because people gravitate to find information, whereas other times they might have different listening habits. And other big events also make people change their listening habits on radio. For instance, in summer, when we're at the beach, we like music. Mm. And so music stations go up during summer. During the football final season, those stations that have live commentary get a boost. So there are a lot of seasonal factors that affect radio ratings, and certainly I think the election is one of them.
In the past, radio has been really critically important in elections. The atmospherics around this one is that it's less important than it's been before.
Yes, I'm not so sure about that. Yes, there's a whole lot of new media, and everybody's on Twitter, and social media is big. No question about that. But just look at the way that the ratings this week have fluctuated. And I think you see that radio still matters and people are still listening to radio and changing their radio listening habits because they're seeking information about the election.
I was just thinking in the past, though, John Howard famously used talkback. Kevin Rudd in 2007, if you go back two elections, assiduously courted FM radio to get that younger demographic. I'm just not hearing them in the same way this time.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. Perhaps this election, there's been less of it, although, you know, there's a lot of politicians going on FM breakfast shows doing funny stunts with crazy morning radio announcers. It's still happening in each electorate.
Okay, well, is there any evidence at all that people are changing stations to avoid the election?
Yes.
I know some people are not watching things like 7:30 on ABC, just anecdotally, because they're kind of over the election.
I suspect there are people like that, although, interestingly, I don't think this ratings survey this week showed that. It showed that music stations have gone down and stations covering the election have gone up a bit. I mean, it's not as simple as that, but generally that trend is there. But I'm sure everybody who works in radio has heard stories from listeners ringing up to say, no more politicians, please.
Yes.
On the other hand, though, while those people might go away from those stations for a time, I think there are a lot of other people coming to those stations to get their quick fix of what's the update on the election.
All right, let's talk about these ratings, which some of which has overlapped with the election. The thing that really leaps out is actually counterintuitive and counter what we've just been talking about. So Triple J has won Perth.
I know, it's unprecedented, amazing, and a great credit to Triple J. They are the number one station in Perth. This is unheard of. And I think there is an election factor. I also think there are some other local factors too. But if it had only been Perth, then you couldn't put it down to the election. But if you look at Triple J across all the capital cities in the ratings, then you'll see that it's gone up everywhere. And I think Triple J, when the analysis of this election is done, will be seen to have played a big part in young people's voting. Now, this is an election where particularly Labor, with Kevin Rudd and his selfies, is trying to mobilise the young vote.
Mm.
And if you're young and you want to find out about information, you aren't going to go to those fuddy-duddy old stations like Radio National or those old-fashioned talk stations commercial radio puts out. You're going to go to a station which you're comfortable with, which gives you trusted opinions on music trends, but also gives you really insightful talk in programs like Hack and The Breakfast Show.
Right.
So I think that Triple J is, the success of Triple J is reflecting that the young audience is taking notice of what they have to say in terms of election coverage.
So I'm going to let slide the Radio National comment.
We're
pretty young and hip and cool around here.
You are, Richard.
But Triple J, you're saying, despite the fact that it's basically seen as a music station and music's the core of its identity, it's actually the talk that they do that you think may be having the effect.
I think so. And I think you can't just say Triple J is a music station. I think it's a youth station that is credible, that people are taking recommendations from about what music they should listen to, and they're probably also transferring that credibility aspect to the talk programs as well.
Steve, I want to ask you about ratings because I know we're going to change how we do ratings next year. Just briefly, what's going to change? What have we got and what are we going to get?
Yeah, what we've had before is a system that was developed 60 years ago where people were asked to voluntarily fill in a book, a kind of a graph book, which said Monday to Friday, list of stations, every 15 minutes, please tick this box if you listen. And that was terrific 60 years ago. But nowadays, you're really hard-pressed to get people to use pen and paper in that way for a survey. They want to be able to put their information in through their iPhone or their tablet or some other electronic device because it's more relevant. They carry it with them and it's easier. So that's the crux of the change. For the first time in 60 years, the ratings contract is moving from Nielsen, the company that had it, to a new company called GfK, which has the new contract. And it will measure pretty much in the same methodology. It will still be ask people to tick the 15 minutes by 15 minutes they listen to, but it will do it on new devices. So it's a kind of a step forward. It's not people meters. I mean, we have the technology where your phone or any kind of device the company would give you would actually listen to the station and would automatically track what you're listening to, but that's not this people meter technology because it's pretty expensive. It's one step towards that, I suppose, making it easier in the electronic sense to be able to register your listening habit.
So it should be more accurate, you would think. And I'm wondering if it will particularly improve things when it comes to
in-car listening. I think apart from the US, we do more in-car listening than any other country. And it has traditionally been a bit vague, hasn't it?
It has. And evidence from this kind of monitoring in other countries shows that in-car listening and also breakfast show listening go up because you can capture it more easily. There was another factor too. A couple of years ago, a survey in Tasmania was abandoned because the survey company couldn't get enough young people to bother to fill in this paper and pencil diary. So there's been a worry that while the old methodology may still be okay, young people just can't be bothered. So again, this will help reinstate the ability to track young people's listening habits.
Steve Ahern speaking to our good friend Richard Ady. Well, usually at this point of the program, we turn to Dan Hensley to talk about propagation, but we're not going to do that quite just yet, because this past week, Dan Hensley broke a story about a space satellite service that's shutting down at the end of September. Dan, can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Well, formerly known as NAV Spacer, that's NAVSPASUR, the Air Force Space Surveillance Radar transmits 800 kilowatts of continuous wave radio power into an east-west oriented fan beam at 216.98 megahertz. The radar's primary mission is to track satellites and space debris for the U.S. Space Command. It can detect objects as small as 10 centimeters orbiting 15,000 kilometers above the Earth's surface.
Now, you actually reported on the radio propagation section of our website that they're going to be shutting it down at the end of September.
Yes, that's correct. That's because of the U.S. federal sequester going on right now, because the United States Congress failed to come together to meet certain budgetary requirements.
Now, if they shut it down, does it still have the possibility of coming back?
Well, that is a good question, and that would depend on whether or not U.S. Congress can work with each other and with President Barack Obama to approve the necessary budgetary items that need to be in place to operate certain federal programs, and this is one of them.
Now, let me ask you, that you just said, of course, they check out like space debris and stuff like that. Is this also used, for example, to check how close meteors are coming to our little planet?
Yes, that would be correct, because as you are aware, this is one of those things that is used to ping those items. So yes, they can measure how close those items are to Earth, and that would include meteors.
So Dan, I mean, if they're checking out meteors, and let's say they do away with this system, is this the only one in existence, or do other countries have a similar system?
Well, you know, I'm not sure which countries have what satellites in place. And as far as the United States is concerned, we do have satellites up there, believe it or not, that have a top secret rating. Over the last several years, there have been several satellites launched into space that were rated as top secret. So what those satellites do, what their mission is, what they're looking at, and all of that, nobody really knows except for the properly classified and security cleared people.
Right. Okay. Well, I'm sure this is a story that we're going to be following up. We'll have to see what happens, if they get a budget, if it comes back or not. But let's turn our attention to propagation and what we can expect over the next 7 days.
Well, propagation from August 31st to September 6th looks like this. The 10.7 centimeter flux on August 31st and September 1st will be 90, rising to 100 September 2nd, 105 on September 3rd and 4th, 110 on September 5th, and 115 on September 6th. An A index spiking at 15 on August 31st and September 1st, down 5 points to 10 on September 2nd, 5 on September 3rd and 4th, 8 on September 5th, down to 5 on September 6th. A KP index of 4 on August 31st and September 1st, 3 on September 2nd. On September 3rd and 4th, a KP index of 2, 3 on September 5th, back down to 2 on September 6th. And we're back down to 5 sunspots this week as 18, 23, and 28 pass out of view. 1834, 35, and 36 are in view. We see no current threats for solar flares this week. Solar wind flowing from a coronal hole should reach Earth on August 30th to 31st. Back to you, Keith.
All right, thank you very much, Dan. And if you want to find out more information about Dan's propagation forecast, you can always check out www.pcjmedia.com/rprop. That's R-P-R-O-P. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
And with that, we conclude this edition of Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. If you wish to let us know what you think of the program, do let us know with the following email address, mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. And of course, do let us know where you heard it. It was either shortwave, AM, FM, or satellite, because the monthly edition of the show also airs in a number of places, just as the weekly version does. If you want to listen to this program again or catch past editions, visit our website, www.pcjmedia.com/Media Network Plus, all one word. So until next time, friends, this is Keith Powell wishing you well, saying so long, take care, 73 and 88 to the ladies.